I'm Kim, and welcome to Esoteric's podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of November 24th, 2014. Join us this week as we visit with Steve Leck, historian and docent with the Mission Inn Foundation, to learn about that hotel's rich history, which dates back more than a century. We'll also talk with Aaron Geddes, principal planner and city historic preservation officer for the City of Riverside, about Riverside's great mid-century modern architecture and the recent public policy decisions that foster its preservation. So stay tuned.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Hermina between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine of fabulous oddities like Brew Cheers, Dairy, Angela Savvy, Bob's Big Boy, in Downey Forest Lawn Cemetery. You can't eat the sunshine, but make a beeline.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of November 24th, 2014. Our guest this week will be Steve Leck. He is a docent with the Mission Inn Foundation. That means he gives tours of the Mission Inn in Riverside, California. He's been doing it since the late 1980s, and there is little you can get past this guy. He's very good. We're also going to talk with Aaron Geddes. She is the Historic Preservation Officer and Principal Planner for the City of Riverside. And that means she is she's the preservation person. And we're going to talk to her about mid-century modern in the City of Riverside. And she is really walking that walk, Kim. She is really talking that talk because, she's just dyed in the wool. So we're very, very happy about this interview with her. We're gonna we'll get into that. Kim, you are the Pishka Queen, so please tell us about the Pishka.
Well, I've been elevated to Queen. I'm no longer Maven. Interesting. Ah, the Pishka of which Richard speaks. It is the digital tip jar. It's associated with this podcast. And if you dig what we do and you'd like to help support our work, you're cordially encouraged to log in and give us a few shekels through PayPal, or you can also ask for instructions for sending a check. We are always so grateful for the support of our gracious and gentle listeners. It is never obligatory, always appreciated, and it keeps us in gasoline and chili relleno burritos, which are, you know, I won't say our two favorite things, but they're both important fuels for all the work we're doing.
We had a soft serve ice cream when we did this interview at the Dairy Queen, but we'll get into that.
Actually, I was sort of astonished by that. I mean, it was like, it was very fluffy.
It's hydrogenated oils, Kim. It's really we're not going to get started on it on a Dairy Queen soft serve. Okay, it's just fast food, but I'm glad we had one, and I'm glad we talked to our friends, and we'll get into all of that in a minute. Okay, Teresa's saga is okay. So, closely watched trains. This is the next segment on our podcast. We talk about things that we're watching, things we care about. Have we mentioned in the last 2 years that we took this title from my favorite Czechoslovakian film from 1963, Closely Watched Trains?
No, I don't think we have. Do you want to do a little bit of film criticism now, or do you want to just throw that out there?
I just feel like every 2 years I should just say that this is a very good Czechoslovakian film called Closely Watched Trains, and everyone should watch it, and it's about trains that are carrying munitions through Czechoslovakia.
I thought you weren't going to do this. You know,
it wasn't film criticism. It was the history of Czechoslovakia and the occupation by the Wehrmacht. But we should move on. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's not going to happen. But I should say that every time you say it's time for the Closely Watched Train section, I think it'd be so cute if we had like a little train sound effect. But every time I bring that up, you tell me that's not going to happen.
I can't find the soundtrack for Closely Watched Trains. I guess I guess at this point, I should probably just pull the opening credit music off the top of the film.
You're really not paying attention, are you?
You said train, like choo choo.
Yeah, and you've been thinking about getting this. You're not giving me a choo choo sound because you don't have the soundtrack to this Czech movie. This is our life, guys. This is our life. Can we move on, please?
Well, we have to get into the closely watched train. So this week's episode is about Riverside, and our first closely watched train is about Modesto. And I'm not saying that these two towns have a lot in common, but at an abstraction, what's happening in Modesto is very similar to what's happening in Riverside. And this Modesto closely watched train, this is all about this gentleman named Bob Barzan, who is the chief executive officer of the Modesto Museum. Interesting, you have to read this article. It's a really interesting saga about how he came to Modesto in 2000. There's nothing. They kind of said they had a museum, and they really didn't. But they wanted to focus on the modern architecture in Modesto and how important it was, and they realized how unique this school of Modesto mid-century modern is, which is exactly what this entire podcast, our interview with Aaron is about, mid-century modern Riverside. So, 2014, they have tours. This whole world has evolved around the development of Modesto modernism, and we're going to put links up, and I cannot wait to go interview them, and we saw this for Bakersfield. We talked about this in Bakersfield about a month ago. So I'm just so happy that all these cities are advocating for and demarcating the spaces that their own unique strains of mid-century modern contain. And it just makes me so happy because it just makes me think Benedict Toshin will never write books about this, or will never, publish books about this.
And what I like about it is, modernism, mid-century modern has become at once so trendy and almost such a cliche with that Mad Men show and with Palm Springs modernism and all the partying around it and all the incredibly valuable real estate transactions that take place. And I love the fact that there's also a celebration of modernism in these completely uncool, funky farmer towns. So you can go and you can celebrate modernism, and you don't actually have to dress up and be fabulous. You can actually just dig the architectures, and that is a cool thing.
Okay, just to clarify for everyone listening, Modesto and Bakersfield, I definitely would classify in over the scope of the last 200 years as farm towns. Riverside has lost a great deal. Riverside is the original.
I was not saying that Riverside was a farm town.
Riverside is, I think, we're going to focus.
We're talking about gentleman farmers. That's a very different thing.
I imagine some people in the city of Riverside are going to be listening to this to figure out what Aaron's saying and make sure they're happy with it. And I don't want to step on any toes.
Honey, at this moment, I've got Palm Springs on one hand, and I got Modesto and Bakersfield on the other. And Riverside, that comes later.
Don't
put words in my mouth.
Okay, I'm not. All right, Kim. So Kim, let's just I noticed you sent me a link. John Raby's Off Ramp, John Raby's show Off Ramp, did a feature on our favorite forgotten Los Angeles writer Jim Tully.
Los Angeles. One might say Ohio.
Okay, well, he settled in Los Angeles in 1912. He became Charlie Chaplin's publicist, and by 1920.
So he was with Chaplin in the late 20s.
Yeah, he got here. Okay, he was with Chaplin. No, he was a Chaplin in 17. He started publishing novels in the mid-20s, and Jim Tully is the guy that invented the hard-boiled school of American fiction, in my opinion. Beggars of Life knocks it out of the park and never stopped. Did a nice piece on it. They interviewed the biographers whom we did a salon with a couple years back.
Yeah, and I love that Tully keeps coming back because it's such a terrific story. And, there's kind of an unlimited number of terrific writers to discover. And it's always nice when one of the lost ones gets the light shown on them. And, almost a 15-minute radio piece, that is pretty cool. You never know. That was a surprise.
Jim Tully rode his way out of he rode his way out of the life, as hobos call it. He rode the rails, left an orphanage, 13 or 14, rode the rails for about 4 years, did a series of odd jobs, had a marriage, came to Los Angeles, fell in love with the climate, and just started writing from this voice deep within him while riding the rails one day that said, you have to write. And so he's just such a great story. Became Chaplin's publicist, sat with him in that booth that Chaplin adored at Musso and Frank for insufferable lunches. He hated Chaplin, ultimately. Just really difficult guy.
Well, yeah, he's got this unpublished, considered unpublishable at the time, Chaplin biography, which is sitting over at UCLA if you want to go have a look at it. And the most important thing to remember about Tully, especially at a time like this, when libraries are at risk, when libraries are being shut down, being privatized, losing books, losing space, getting sold to the highest bidder to be turned into mixed-use developments, he was a road kid. He was basically sold into indentured servitude by his dad as an early teen, and he ran away, and he taught himself how to think and how to read and how to write in the libraries because they were warm, and that first marriage of his was to a librarian. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we want more Jim Tullys, we need to support our libraries. And I want more Jim Tullys. I mean, gosh, why wouldn't you want more Jim Tullys?
And read the biography. Yeah. Mark and Paul's biography is fantastic. We'll include a link to it. There's a link to it in the off-ramp piece, so that's sufficient. I don't want to overwhelm people with links.
Oh, yeah, no, we're going to include our own link because it's going to go to the Esoteric Emporium of L.A. Lore Store, and the holidays are coming up, and, you know, you may want to get something special for someone you love. And also, now that I bring it up, we have our holiday gift certificate sale as well, so we should put that link up because through December 24th, not on Christmas Day. If you wait that long, well, you could beg us. But through December 24th, we have a nice special on gift certificates purchased in bulk. If you get as many as 4, you'll start saving money. And we do this every year, and it's always nice to help people who don't really want to, you know, decide on a lot of different presents. Just give people the Esoteric Bus Adventure of your choice.
Okay. James Elroy can't give you your gift certificates if you buy them, though.
That was the first year, yeah. We actually, someone bought a lot of gift certificates, and I was meeting James Elroy. Joan and I were meeting James Elroy over in Beverly Hills, and we just arranged to meet this guy and give him the tickets. And he was really happy. He's like, wait, I get to buy these gift certificates and meet James Elroy? I'm like, yeah, we got about 10 minutes. So that's what we did. That's not going to happen this year, but you can hold that close to your heart. You never know when you'll hit the jackpot in life.
All right, Kim. You get to take us home with Closely Watched Trains. You're going to talk about Adrian Scott Fine, advocate for the Los Angeles Conservancy. He wrote an editorial piece in the Downtown News about your buddy Bob Baker.
Yeah, the Bob Baker Marionette Theater is facing a really interesting preservation challenge. A few years back, it was named a historic cultural monument, which means that a rather undistinguished structure that since the early 1960s has functioned pretty much every day of the year as the greatest marionette puppet theater for children in the world. It is among the longest lived in the entire world, and it's certainly the only thing of its kind in Los Angeles and still has a show almost every day. The property has, you know, there have been a lot of financial problems. Basically, Bob has subsidized the theater for many, many years, and there have been some inappropriate intrigues involving real estate scumbags repeatedly. And Bob is an artist, and he's been taken advantage of, and all I'm saying is someone else owns the property now, and they have big plans. Not saying they're one of the big scamsters. There were worse ones. They have big plans. They got the property at a discount because it's a historic cultural monument, and when you buy a historical cultural monument, there are limitations to what you can do. So they came up with this really groovy plan to destroy the theater and put some pictures of puppets up in their mixed-use development. So, it's not so great, and the Historic Cultural Landmarks Board, what are they called, honey?
CHC.
Right, Cultural Heritage Commission, was sort of unimpressed with the plan, because when you look at it, it's just an archway that goes over the existing theater, which then has the entire backstage and performance area lopped off, so it's not functional anymore. So what we were really happy to see was that Adrian Scott Fine from the Conservancy wrote this op-ed for the Downtown News in response to some coverage of the report on this proposed mixed-use development on the site, and did what the Conservancy is supposed to do, which is to advocate for the preservation of historic and cultural landmarks, and pointed out, you know, even though the Cultural Heritage Commission said, you know, if the puppet theater isn't in the theater space anymore, it may not matter to preserve this building at all, even though it's a landmark, because it's a landmark for cultural reasons, so we don't like your plan. What the Conservancy's perspective is, actually, it's a landmark for cultural reasons, and that's why we need to preserve the culture within it. The building's important, the culture's within it, it is completely unique, and if we don't save these things, what do we really have to show as Angelenos? So it's something to think about. You know, it's a large plot of land, and there are other things that can be done, and a new proposal can be put forward that actually preserves the theater. So let's hope that's what's going to happen. It's always helps to have these voices of advocacy organizations raised before decisions are made. And, you know, we've been critical of the Conservancy on this podcast in the past.
We'll continue to be, probably.
Yeah, but I want, you know, we definitely want to cheer them when they're doing what we believe their mission statement calls on them to do, which is to advocate for the preservation of important spaces in Los Angeles.
Right, and let me just remind everyone, you know, the Conservancy is a California public benefit corporation. It's not a person, so I can't take the Conservancy out to dinner and talk about when we made that independent film back in the early 1990s and went to Sundance. I can't do that because they're an entity, and that's just what it is. There are many directions. So, Kim, we're going to move on. We're gonna talk about upcoming events. To imitate Chevy Chase, the Lava Sunday Salon is still on hiatus. Remember, Gerald Ford's still dead? Yeah. The Lava Sunday Salon is still on hiatus. We're getting very close to solving this problem, and I appreciate everyone's patience and look forward to the solution.
Patience? You don't have to deal with the emails. Cam, tell Richard I really miss the salon. I love getting together with everyone on Sunday and having a meal and hearing the speakers. I do too.
We're very close, okay? We're going to move on, okay? I'm working on it, Kim.
Okay? I know. I'm just saying. But we're doing an event. We're doing a literary gathering, which is kind of in the spirit of a salon.
What is that, Kim?
Oh, we're doing the Raymond Chandler, in his own words, book signing and talk and walking tour with Barry Day on December the 7th. And hopefully I know because I've been seeing the signups, a lot of our regular salon attendees are coming to this free event. And if you're a salon person and you're listening and you haven't signed up yet, or you're just curious about what the salons have been all about, it would be a good introduction to these sort of cultural presentations we've been doing downtown.
Yeah, I don't want to show my hand too much, but this event is going to look, the Lava Sunday Salon is going to look a lot more like this event coming up on the 7th than the Lava Salon has looked for the last 2 years. I don't mean there's going to be a sea change, but it's...
Yeah, and what Richard's talking about is something that we've been thinking about for a while, which is that we have all these really great presenters, and we've been kind of front-loading the salons with so much lecturing and not enough interaction and community building. Oh, God, that sounds so corny. It sounds like I'm writing a grant. But we just want people to have more time to just kind of rub shoulders and get to know each other and talk about what folks who don't happen to be on stage that day are up to. So it's going to be perhaps a little longer and a little more freeform when we bring it back.
Okay, there you go. You heard it from Kim, not me. All right, looking past the holidays, and it's so amazing that Thanksgiving is in 4 days. It's like the greatest thing in the world. Looking past the holidays into 2015, we have a forensic science seminar coming up January 18th with
Ed Nordskog, the arson investigator to the stars.
Okay, I don't know if... Okay, Ed is a genius. I don't think he's... Okay, Kim, thank you. Ed's great. You should come to this forensic science seminar. And we're certainly going to be we're looking forward to scheduling the rest of the year for the forensic science seminars in the next couple of months. So we're really excited. All right, so we need to move into the interviews. We're going to interview Steve first, so I'm going to introduce Erin first. Erin Geddes, she is Principal Planner and Historic Preservation Officer for the City of Riverside. That means she is the person that is there when the rubber hits the road for preservationist public policy in the City of Riverside. She wears several other hats in the city, and we'll get back to interviews with her about those other hats, which are equally as interesting. But her historic preservation hat puts her as the principal author of contact statements about mid-century modernism in Riverside, and that is the subject of this interview. I don't want to give anything away, so I'm going to... There are a couple... She's living the life. She's living the dream. She really is. She's fantastic. So let's see. Things to look forward to with Erin. We're going to do a drive-through with her later in the year. We're going to go back to Riverside and actually do on-site walkthroughs of mid-century modern gems with her. And so we're going to hear a lot more from her. She's absolutely fantastic, don't you think, Kim?
I'm hoping there'll be more soft serve, because I want to see if you can actually take the soft serve and hold it upside down and not have it fall out of the cone.
Yeah, that's yes, hydrogenated oils, yes.
Cool, can't wait.
Yeah. Okay, good. So Aaron's our second interview. Steve. Steve is our first interview. Steve is a docent with the Mission Inn Foundation and Museum. He has been a docent since the late 1980s. He's going to talk about being in the Mission Inn like I was when the last week they closed in 1985. I didn't take any pictures, or if I did, I can't find the negatives. But he took a lot of pictures, and that sort of witness state of his helped him a couple years later. Well, they reopened in 7 years later. They opened in 93. So when they reopened in 93... he was there giving tours, and that arc helped him and enriches his knowledge and experience with the Mission. And he gives us just a fantastic, it's like a 20-25 minute interview, and we just go soup to nuts, birth to terminus in 85 to reopening in 93.
And for anyone who doesn't know, the Mission Inn is, it's not just a hotel. I mean, it's a compound. It's massive. It's exquisite. It's a series of interconnected, aesthetically complete spaces that are meant to evoke the old world in the new. And I never saw it when it was much decayed. It's kind of hard to imagine because it's so perfect and pristine now. I really want to see those photographs. I think it's one of the most beautiful spaces. Series of spaces in Southern California.
I really wanted to include the Mission Inn when it was closed in my oral exams for art history, because it was just such a totally whacked out space. But my ability to research, no one was writing about the Mission Revival in those days. Okay, Bob Winter was. My training was in modernism. And I just really didn't have another year of my life while living in Santa Cruz to research what we do now. So it's that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't even know where to start. We're going to get into, okay.
Well, not long after that, I was thinking about this last week when we were at UC Santa Barbara doing some architectural archive work. I was remembering the research paper that I did for David Gephardt on the interior decoration of the Spanish colonial revival, which just involved going through all of these decorating magazines and kind of analyzing the language that was being used to sell the Spanish colonial revival. While we were going through these archives, we were seeing all these really interesting niche publications that existed for industries, like their multiple hoteliers publications, and I guess that's probably what you would have needed to go to.
Kim, so what I'm trying to say is, you know, the Flaneur in the City walking tour series, which is, you can find on Lava, the Lava site. So really what I'm trying to tell you is in 1985, I saw the Mission Inn completely dilapidated and then shut down by the county. And then in 90, when I was putting my oral exams together, I really wanted to talk about the Mission Inn, which was this this shell that was being restored. And I didn't really have the tools to talk about 19th century Los Angeles. And really only, I mean, that's the reason I started the Flaneur in the City series, is because I said, oh, my wife really wants me to finish the tour book, but I can't really finish the tour book until I do one of three things. The most important and the hardest one is understand that the beginning and the end of the 19th century in Los Angeles is all about the mission. So really what I'm saying is it took all my skills as an adult, not a 20-year-old, but a, you know, in my early 40s, a researcher in my early 40s, with several people who studied with me at Santa Cruz, to really answer the question, the beginning and the end of the 19th century in Los Angeles is the mission and what that means.
Yes, and the Flaneur in the City is coming back with no mission revival, so stay tuned. It's going to be a lot of sex and violence.
Yeah, because, you know, I wanted to put sex and violence in my oral exams too, but, you know, that's another story. So we're going to pull back our focus to the mission in Riverside. We're going to move immediately into our interview with Steve about the history and splendor of this fascinating place. And I would not be doing a proper service to the mission if I did not mention, and that's the reason we put this interview this week instead of the week next.
However,
Festival of Lights.
The Festival of Lights is coming up, and 750 million people are going to be passing through the doors of the Mission Inn and harassing the parrots and Steve. And you do not need to go and take the tour during the Festival of Lights. I mean, if you happen to be in the vicinity, you can look at it. But go see Steve after. Right?
No, I want everyone to go see Steve this week. Festival of Lights.
Come on, you're not even going to get 30 seconds with the guy.
Okay. Yeah. Festival of Lights will starts on the 28th, so it starts at the end of this week.
It's not really 700 million.
It's 40,000 people. Steve said it took he and his wife like half an hour to get to get from the curb to the lobby of the hotel last year. So some people like that. So let's take it away with an interview with Steve about the historic Mission Inn in Riverside, California. Steve, I'm here with you. We're at the Mission Inn in Riverside, California, and I would like you to properly introduce yourself. Tell us your role here, which you've had for decades, and a little bit about this wonderful place before we jump into the deep end.
My name is Steve Leck, and I'm with the Mission Inn Foundation. Been one of the docents here since 1988, and been enjoying doing tours and researching the history of Riverside's nationally registered historic hotel here for a number of years.
Perfect. Okay, let's, first things first, the Mission Inn has an annual festival, which is about to begin week next, the 28th of November, the Friday after Thanksgiving. You just want to spend 30 seconds and tell us about this event, which I think last year took you half an hour to get through the lobby of the hotel, so everyone be warned, this is a crowded event he's about to describe.
Right. Well, the Festival of Lights actually got started back in 1993 after the original reopening of the hotel, and it's grown ever since. And so by now, I believe there's something like more than 4 million lights that are being put on the Mission Inn, along with other decorations, the stars in there, Santas, et cetera. And it's a major attraction now in downtown Riverside. It attracts about 30,000 to 40,000 people for the lighting ceremony, and then throughout the holidays and into New Year's, many, many more thousands come to enjoy the lights, the carolers, and just kind of the festive activities going on around downtown.
Perfect. Okay. I'm going to throw something question at you. I just thought of this as you were talking. Before we start describing this gorgeous structure, which has about a 30-year building history spanning early at the part of the 20th century through the early 30s, this place, I remember in the early 80s, this place was just closing, and then it reopened again in 93. Could you just give us a little bit about, because when I was a teenager and I started to try and drive around
and look at neat places around Los Angeles County. I remember this just in the back of my mind as something that was open, and I drove out, and, like, I got a tour, but it was closing. So just give us, before we get back to 1904, tell us a little about more recent history before it reopened in 93.
Well, what you're describing in the 80s was really the end of a long decline for the building. It was in really bad shape. It was owned by the city. And they had finally made the decision that they need to sell it to somebody who will restore it, because it was in just absolutely abysmal shape. And so what you're describing, of course, is the closing of it in 1985. What was supposed to happen was it was going to close for about 2 years for renovation. 2 years became 7.5 years because the entity that bought it, they got most of the restoration done, but then they went under.
Oh.
And it was deeded back to Chemical Bank, and they held it for a number of years, too. But it was finally picked up at the towards the end of 1992 by Dwayne Roberts, who's the current owner of it. And he got, well, actually a soft opening at the end of 92, and then kept opening more and more throughout 93 till May of 93 when we had the grand opening here.
Perfect. Okay, thank you for that. I just remembered as you were talking. I remember being, it was like a haunted house. It was so great in 1985. It was like, wow. All right. So we're overlooking a courtyard, one of the what we can see an original part of the hotel. So why don't you just start? Let's go back to the 1870s with this site and just bring us up to about 1915, and we'll take a break and again get some comic relief and sort of keep it moving.
Okay. Well, in the 1870s, you know, Riverside was founded in 1870, and within just a few years the Miller family came out here and they bought this entire block that's bounded by 6th, 7th, Main and Orange here in downtown, basically at the center of town. And they built an adobe building that they started renting rooms in, and that's really what started the hotel. Frank Miller, the oldest son, was about 17 when he bought it from his dad. His dad really didn't want anything to do with the hotel business. And so he bought it and kept it going throughout the 80s and 90s. But it was very much your cottage type of hotel. It wasn't a nice place, just a cottage type of hotel. But in those ensuing years, Riverside grew to be the wealthiest per capita city in the country because of the naval orange industry. And, of course, the naval orange industry started here in Riverside. This is where the two-parent naval orange trees were.
Right.
So a lot of people are coming out here now, 80s, 90s, 1900s, and they're buying 5, 10, 20 acres, planting them to citrus and becoming rather wealthy after a few years. So we're attracting a lot of wealth out here, too. The problem is that the wealthy people wouldn't stay here in Riverside. They'd come out, they'd look, they might invest, but they wouldn't stay here. And that ticked off Frank Miller and many other city leaders. So Frank Miller gets the idea in about 1894 to build a truly grand hotel here in Riverside. That doesn't happen for almost 10 more years because he has funding issues. But basically by about 1902 now he's ready to go with his dream.
Oh, I'm going to interrupt you. 1893 is a huge crash. There's a big crash. So, but lack of money in 1894 should not surprise anyone at all.
It certainly doesn't. It certainly doesn't. But what does surprise people, especially afterwards in his business acumen, is that it took him almost 10 years to raise the money there. But he finally does in the name of Henry Huntington. And Henry Huntington, of course, owns the Pacific Electric lines, and he invests along those lines. So you buy a ticket and ride his train. Course. So he's good friends with Miller, and they put up the money, and Miller is ready to go when he becomes a good friend with Arthur Benton. Now, Arthur Benton, of course, is an architect in Los Angeles, and Benton's big, his draw is that we should build buildings here to resemble the missions. And when I say here, I mean all of Southern California, of course. His thought is, if people are coming out to see them, let's give them missions. And he has a big influence on Miller. And Miller sees that as really kind of the crick, if you will, the thing that will make this unique. So he has Benton draw up the plans for a very mission-influenced hotel building. And that's what you see when you come to the front portion of the Mission Inn. You see a U-shaped building that you're in the courtyard of, and that's the first part that was built in 1902 and opened in 1903, then under Benton's tutelage, Huntington's money, and Frank Miller's dream.
Okay. Perfect. Let's stop for a second. I want you to orient us to the train stations,
okay?
Because that's what people were getting here back in the day. So that's really important.
Right. Well, Riverside had three train stations by this time. They had the Santa Fe, which was the original one, the Salt Lake Depot, which would come in 1904, and also the Southern Pacific. The Southern Pacific is only about two blocks down from here. That would be west. And the other two are almost across the street from each other, about five blocks east here. And 7th Street, which the Mission in front's on, is really the main highway here. This is the main highway to take you into L.A. Man. So as you're coming in from L.A., you're right here on 7th Street, and you're going to see the inn. Conversely, if you're coming here on the train, you're going to detrain over here on Vine Street, come up 7th about five, six blocks, and boom, you're right in the middle of town, and you're right here at the Mission Inn.
All this talk of trains has made me think of Harvey Girls. I'm not going to ask you about Harvey Girls, but I am going to ask you about the challenge Benton had of housing female employees in a remote area. So I'm going to ask you about the annex, just the dormitories that he built, just because it's right across the street.
Yeah, well, Miller actually housed most of his employees here on the block originally. He had to. Most of the people who lived here in Riverside were either working in their own businesses or working in the groves. So Miller had to pull in his employees from far and wide. So he housed them here. Later on in the 20s, he actually built the annex that you were discussing across the street on 6th Street. And that was strictly for employee housing plus shops, there was laundry, some of the other things, storage that you would use in a hotel. So the building that directly fronts 6th Street was the women's dorm. That was built first, and then about a year or two later, behind it, the men's dorm was built. Then, and that had some of the machine shops in it too and stuff like that. It was really the operational aspect of the hotel. And if you've noticed, there's a bridge that connects the two buildings. If you take from the annex over the bridge, you're basically over the service entrance of the hotel. So it's just a quick drop down a few flights of stairs, and you're right there where you'd clock in, get your assignments, whatever, or take off and go to either cook or be a maid or a butler or a waiter or front desk staff or whatever else should be here.
Okay, perfect. Let's can you give us... When was this threat? There was the winter season. People came out for the winter. So could you give us a sense of what this would have been like, say, in the winter of 1906, 1907? It opened for a couple of years. It was gaining some traction.
It was very much gaining traction. It was very popular even from the beginning because Miller just did an awful lot of advertising for it. It was became California's unique hotel, and that's what he wanted. What would you have seen here? You would have seen probably a scene like today. It was very clear, a little windy, very nice temperature. You'd come out probably October, November, probably stay till March, April. You would have business interests still back east, but this is where you'd come out to winter to escape the snowdrifts and the cold weather, et cetera. This would really be your address. And when we look at old newspapers, people say, I'm here on business or I'm here to stay for the winter. My address is the Glenwood or the Mission Inn or so.
Wow.
So you would have seen a number of people out here either just enjoying the climate. They would have been taking advantage of some of Miller's various activities that were here. In the hotel itself, they had Sunday service sing-alongs, they had afternoon teas, they had pageants, but he also had excursions up and down Magnolia Avenue in Victoria, which were our two main thoroughfares through the groves. You could go up Mount Rubidoux and look out the entire city. You could take in maybe a round of golf at the Victoria Club, which was founded basically at the same time here. Maybe even go hunting, take an excursion to the beach maybe. Just you're really out here to enjoy the climate, relax, and not be bothered with the freezing cold that you would if you came from Chicago, New York, Boston, what have you.
Perfect. Okay, let's get to the skin and bones of this hotel now. So we're standing in this courtyard. We're next to the Japanese pavilion. We're looking at the backside of the original U that you just described. Why don't you take us up phase one to phase two, as we discussed right before we started recording. So take us up through phase two, and we'll take a breath.
Okay. Well, the original portion was a U shape that basically took in half the block. It's come 1909, now he needs more private rooms. So he adds what was called the cloister wing to the back portion of the hotel going down the east side along Orange Street to 6th. And it's interesting, Benton is the architect again. Arthur Benton is called back in. And he, in this instance, emulates the missions. This isn't the romanticized look at the missions that the front wing is. He's actually copying various aspects. If you look at the Orange Street side, you see buttresses that are taken from the San Gabriel mission. Yeah. You look at the 6th Street facade, that looks like the Carmel Mission Chapel, elongated, obviously. The arched arcade that's in the courtyard is from San Juan Capistrano there. And there are other elements, too, that he's literally copying, because at this point, a lot of people are thinking the missions are gone, or are done for, I should say. The Landmarks Club that Lummis starts really doesn't do an awful lot. Most of the missions, of course, are revived during the WPA era, much later. So he's copying elements in the hopes of saving the missions in his own view there. And again, Arthur Benton is there to do all of these plans for him, creates the large music room, which is really the mainstay of that cloister wing, a massive room on the, subterranean there, that where he can have his parties, he can have, again, the plays, the pageants, scripture readings. They had all kinds of different ways of entertaining people there. And that brings us up to about it opens in 1911, July of 1911. So it's the 1911-12 winter season that really you see the cloister.
Okay. Perfect. And you answered all my questions about Benton, so we're good.
Okay.
So good. So you're doing great. There's a trip to Spain. And then a new architect is going to come on the scene. So why don't we segue into that?
Okay. Well, he's got the cloister wing done in 1911, and just a year or two later, he takes a trip to Spain. He and his wife and daughter, and he becomes very fascinated with Spanish art, and he decides he's going to make Riverside sort of a hub of Spanish art. So when he comes back, he starts planning for a third wing of the hotel, and this actually regresses in architectural style. He's not using the missions anymore. He's using the Spanish architecture, which is what the missions are based on. And for this one, he hires Myron Hunt, who's probably the most famous of the architects to work on the Mission Inn. He, of course, has done the Rose Bowl, Occidental College, the Huntington Library, a number of other. He's very famous at the time.
And he likes missions. He's done a lot of work with the mission revival, too.
Very much so. Very much so. So Hunt comes in, and he designs a massive room called the Spanish Art Gallery that, from day one, is an art gallery, and that's what it was meant to be used for, and a much smaller number of private rooms. But the biggest thing is it creates the courtyard, the inner courtyard, to the hotel, which is, if you've been there, you know when you go to dine, you can dine inside and outside. Well, the inside is the Spanish dining room, and the outside is part of that Spanish patio there. This is all part of that Spanish wing that comes about in 1914. That. And really, there's also the impetus, too, of that Panama Pacific Exposition that's going to come next year, being done both in San Diego and San Francisco. A lot of people are going to have to come through Riverside, and so he's anticipating a lot more travelers, and that's exactly what happens.
And it's the Panama Exposition, which in many ways births the Spanish colonial revival, which is really the next major iteration of Los Angeles and Riverside County's theme.
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah, this is all done as a way of getting people here, and it's all done sort of choreographed amongst others, too. Very much so.
Perfect. Okay, we're overlooking the Rotunda, which is the last installment of this hotel. So why don't you bring us on home with this last stage of building, which took there's a little break. And this brings us the Rotunda and the Chapel of St. Francis Assisi. So why don't you bring us on home with these two great salient features of this building?
All righty. Well, it took about another 12 years or so to start thinking of finishing off the block there. He was running out of room, obviously, to build on. It's at this time, of course, that the annex that we mentioned beforehand was built. But now, by the mid-20s, he's looking at finishing off the building. And he starts in under the auspices of G. Stanley Wilson. And Wilson is a local architect here in Riverside. And he is a much younger man then, but he takes on the job of building what would become the Rotunda Wing. And the design starts in about 27, 28 there, and he gets started. But, of course, that's when the Depression hits. And things slow down immensely. But by 1931, he's getting towards the end of it. And it's interesting because when you look at the Riverside Press of January 1st of 1931, the main story is about the rotunda because that is the biggest construction project in the county, and they're just really loving Frank Miller for it. The shell of it's done by then. It doesn't get done until about September of 31, and that's really when the entire block now is completed as far as the whole Mission Inn is concerned there. So the rotunda wing here really only has about a dozen private rooms. It's really meant more of a public room. Thing. You had mentioned the rotunda. That was sort of the commercial corner of the hotel. That had offices, right. Shops.
And these are still where conference, there are a lot of conference rooms off the rotunda rooms. Now.
Yes, exactly. Riverside Medical Clinic got their start here. We had physicians' offices here in the rotunda. But, of course, some of the offshoots of it are these St. Francis Chapel that you had mentioned. And that St. Francis Chapel was really meant as a wedding chapel. He'd had weddings here starting back in 1903. You could get married in various places. But by now, he's actually trying to dedicate a spot to it. But he's also bought two sets of artifacts that have to have their own house, in effect. And that's the large altar screen, I should say, that's in there, plus those large Tiffany windows that are in there. Well, he's gotten those about 10 years beforehand. Those both came to the hotel in the early 20s. And they came from different locations. Of course, the altar screen is from Guanajuato, Mexico, which is the old altar screen from a wealthy Mexican family there. He bought that, brought it over here, and it actually stood in the Spanish Art Gallery throughout the 20s. Got lots of shots of that. But then the Tiffany windows came to him via Tiffany himself. He knew Lewis Comfort Tiffany was a guest here for a while. And one day when Miller was back in New York, Tiffany summoned him and said, you need to have these windows. And Miller said, no, I can't afford these things. And they came to some sort of an agreement then. But Tiffany, I think, wanted to unload them. They were massive windows. They had been built for his church, the Madison Square Presbyterian Church in New York. But, of course, that only lasted like 15 years because we were right down the financial center of New York. So they're taking out the church, and he got the windows back. Well, now what do I do with these massive windows? So he liked what Miller was doing here quite a bit. And they came to an agreement somehow, and they came to here also. So he's got these massive windows plus that altar screen. And so when he's building the rotunda here, he tells Wilson to build a special chapel for weddings. That's, you know, the gist of it, but around those two sets of artifacts there. So when you walk in, you're met with a very tall room with that large gold leaf altar screen on the far end, and then on either side of you, you have these massive Tiffany stained glass windows.
It's a gorgeous space, which people get married in all the time.
Constantly.
Several times a weekend, I'm sure.
Yes.
I think we did it. You did it. I want you to talk about what you do here, about people getting here, taking a tour, looking around. Anything, I mean, you probably have several dozen things you want to bring up. Just take a second, and in addition to telling us about the docent program that the foundation runs, anything I've forgotten that you want to remind people about.
Okay, well, the foundation, the Mission Inn Foundation, they operate the educational programs here and the museum, because we do have a massive museum for this place. But we do docent-led tours of the hotel every day except major holidays. It's a good idea to call beforehand to get reservations, obviously. But we do about an hour and a quarter tour throughout, and you get to see a number of the rooms, major rooms. And we explained a lot of the art and architecture, the history, the famous people who have been here, all kinds of different things throughout the tours. And we have got a group of about 120 or so trained docents. And when I say trained, we go through a training class of about 8 or 9 months in length to become docents here.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not a we hand you a script and you do it. You go through about an 8 or 9 month training class there and lead and follow some of the tours, etc., and then get up to speed by the time March, April comes around every year. So
good. I think we did it. We were going to talk about this courtyard very briefly. Oh, wow. So this gets renamed sort of into the South Sea. Do you just want to talk about the South Sea theme and the sort of reinvention for a decade or two?
Well, what we're looking at here is the Court of the Orient, which is the historic name, and again, the name of it today. When Miller built the Rotunda Wing, he also brought in the Asian influence into the building because he wanted to have that in with the North American and European. He was very much a pacifist and brought the cultures of the world together. So what we're looking at is the Court of the Orient. This was done in 1932. Of course, just very soon afterwards was the Japanese incursions into China, which eventually led to the Pacific portion of World War II. So Japan was falling out of favor. And by 1939 now, they've taken a lot of that out and made it into a South Sea supper club called the Lea Lea. And that was combined with a couple other rooms there. And it was a very popular place, very popular, especially during the war. It was like an adjunct officers club here from March Air Force Base, which was the big Air Force base here, Camp Hahn, Camp Anza. Then after the war, it was still very popular. A lot of dignitaries, movie stars were in there too. Unfortunately, during the renovation, it really had to be taken out. It was thrown together very shoddily, and with that South Seas motif with all the bamboo and the palm fronds, the fire marshal had a field day saying what would have to be done, and so they took it all out and they restored the Court of the Orient. So that's what you see today. Then
perfect. I want to thank you, Steve. You've done a great job.
Thank you much. Glad to do it.
My name is Chris Nichols. I'm at the A plus D Museum, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Aaron, I'm here with you. We're in Riverside City Hall. We're in the planning department. We're in a very nice conference room. And I want you to properly introduce yourself. Tell us your title, and we're going to get down to the work at hand, which is preservation and public policy in the city of Riverside in the context of modernism.
Thank you. Yes, I'm Erin Geddes, and I'm the city's historic preservation officer and principal planner. And I oversee historic preservation neighborhoods and urban design.
Perfect. Okay, we've got a list of buildings, and our goal in the next 20 minutes is to bring people up to speed on Riverside as a modernist mecca. And a side effect of this partial, small inventory of modernist gems in Riverside is a sense of your job as the preservation policy person in the city, and how your role and your attitude impacts public policy and preservation. So why don't you start with pick a building and let's just get started. No. Context. Start with a context statement. This is a document we're going to make available. We'll put the PDF link on the website. People can download it. So just start with this. This is 2009, and just tell us about this document.
So anyone who's not familiar with the surveys may not know that in order to go out and start identifying buildings and understanding which of them are important and which ones are significant to certain types of history, you have to prepare a context statement. We originally went to the state and said we wanted to just do a survey of a small area in Riverside, which I'll talk about in a little bit, that's a historic district of homes from the modern period. And they came back and said, you guys need to do a citywide context statement first on modernism. And Riverside is well positioned geographically. We're right between Los Angeles and Palm Springs, two cities that are already known for their modernism treasures. We have a lot as well. I think we rival both of those cities.
You do.
But we didn't have any context sort of documented, written, or published to demonstrate that. So in 2008, we succeeded in our first step towards doing that, and we prepared our first modernism context statement. We've done a subsequent one since then, and we've had some financial support from the State Office of Historic Preservation to do so.
Okay, perfect. And so as a city, as a department, you produce this document, and this document lists really amazing modernist buildings. So let's just roll up our sleeves, jump in, and open people's eyes to the gem, the modernist gem that Riverside is.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so the context statement identifies significant architects, and it identifies significant types of architecture that happened during that time period. And as you probably know, modernism spans the entire gamut. Like, we have everything. So there's buildings that were built for public purposes, like libraries and fire stations. There's buildings that were built for private purposes, for homes or for private businesses. You can actually probably find a modernist building on every single type of need that you would have throughout the city. Some of our great ones are some of those publicly funded projects because there was a huge influx of population in Riverside, much like the rest of Southern California during the modernist time period. So we had to build that infrastructure and catch up really, really quickly. And so that's why we still have, even to this day, a lot of those buildings still in place, including our only building that's on the state register, which is the downtown fire station.
Oh.
That is a modernist building designed by Bolton Moise.
Perfect. And, you know, before we start, and we'll start with the bookend at the beginning, before we start with this first building in this context, I want you to throw out some names of local modern architects. Like the man whose house you live in, okay? You look concerned. Before we get started, why don't you just name one or two Riverside architects that people are going to see once they download this context statement and start making their building their itineraries on Google Maps?
Okay. Right. So I mentioned Bolton Moise, and Moise and Harbuck actually did also the downtown library, which is a really important building. We also have Herman Runau, who was quite prolific throughout Riverside, definitely did the most modernism era structures of any other architect in this area. But the other one, whose house I live in, is Clinton Marr. And Clinton Marr has done a number of buildings, also a wide range. He's done some for hospitals, some for school districts, some for Standard Insurance, as well as some incredible, because I'm really biased, personal residences, including mine, which is a post and beam style house that's built on a 3-foot grid, just like Meespan Row.
Perfect. Okay, so good. And we're going to get into all of this. Let's start with the S. Charles Lee Theater, the De Anza.
Right. So as I mentioned in the modernism context statement, we determine a time period that context applies to. And so that's the period of significance for modernism in Riverside. And at the time that we did this first statement, because there's actually two, we had determined that there were two bookends that kind of helped establish the start and the finish of that context. So our start to modernism in Riverside was the S. Charles Lee building that you mentioned, the De Anza Theater, which is Clark's Nutrition Center today. Inside, not nearly at all indicative of that, but the outside still has really great integrity. It's a streamlined, modern building, so it has a really great asymmetrical entrance. And then it has a few bits of the signage that relate to kind of a little bit of Beaux-Arts. It's thrown in with some streamlined modern, but it's got the speed lines, it's got the smooth stucco, it's got the rounded corner, so there's a lot of pieces to it that are still very indicative of that streamlined modern time period. And it was a whole complex. Today, as part of Clark's Nutrition, it has a number of offices off of the side that are used by individual practitioners, in addition to the large movie theater volume that is the grocery store itself.
Great. Perfect. And let's just keep moving down this list. Pick another one.
Yeah. So the architects I mentioned earlier were Riverside architects that are kind of well known in this area and maybe not as known in other areas, although Runau and Marr did do buildings in other places like the Coachella Valley and San Bernardino, Redlands, and in some cases down in Lake Elsinore and Corona. But we do have one, just one, but we're very proud of it, the Carillion Tower on the UCR campus, which was designed by A. Quincy Jones, who incidentally was a teacher of Clinton Marr's and did spend some time over here as he was designing this building. And so it's sort of the piece that is that clock tower, that sort of modern interpretation of the clock tower. It's also the part of the campus that you can see from anywhere, so it's kind of, you know, something that helps you determine where you are on campus in relationship to. It's kind of that Matterhorn, you know, yes, in Disneyland of the UCR campus. It's also a really well designed building, and also, I believe, done on a grid, but done out of poured-in-place concrete, which incidentally has a long history in Riverside as well. We have a lot of poured-in-place concrete buildings that span far earlier than our modernist time period, so I feel like we have a long history of concrete in this area due to a concrete plant over in the Rubidoux area.
Concrete plants. Perfect. Let's keep going through this list. We still have some great buildings here. The paper cup.
Right. So we also were, Riverside was home to the Lilly Tulip Corporation. And can I take just a quick step back?
Yeah.
So one of the things about Riverside during this time period, again, they were growing so quickly. They actually had, I think because of some of the citrus interest and study that was happening at UCR, there was a very high quality or caliber of individual that was interested in the Riverside area for their types of business. So we're also the home of the Hunter Douglas Corporation. We're the home of Sunkist. Sunkist started here. And so there are several kind of pioneering type movements that started in Riverside. And so for a corporation like the Lilly Tulip Cup to decide to settle here, I think is actually kind of indicative of how Riverside was on the map in this time period and even in the time period before. We weren't a bedroom community, like we had our own identity. So the Lilly Tulip Cup, I believe there are four or five other Lilly Tulip Cup Corporation buildings around the United States, and they decided to settle in Riverside. And Clint Marr actually had his first commission here. It was kind of the one that he was kind of first known for that really made a name for him. He competed against other architects who'd been around a lot longer and won this commission fairly early in his career. The building he designed is not really indicative of what he originally had designed has changed a lot since then. But the one thing that he kind of left his mark on was that the cup is a freestanding cup. And apparently, according to the other buildings that were built, the cup is just a half cup attached to the building. But because Clint wanted his architecture to be free of any sort of ornament, he convinced them to do this freestanding cup. So we're the only Lilly Tulip Corporation plant that has a freestanding cup. And it's a gigantic, yeah, like gigantic, I don't know how tall.
20 feet tall?
Oh, taller.
30 feet. Yeah, okay, 30. Okay, so we're talking about a 35-foot hot beverage cup.
That's right.
In front of the building.
That's right.
Which is executive offices and manufacturing combined.
I know it was definitely manufacturing and at least executive for this area. So, but it's a gigantic cup, and I've heard that it had a fountain at the time. We actually recently did some road improvements over there, and the road improvements went around the Lilly Tulip Cup because we had identified it in the modernism context statement as important. So we still have our big freestanding cup, and it's one of the few examples, aside from some signs that we have that are really phenomenal. We have some great neon. It's one of the few examples we have of kind of that roadside architecture. So.
Before we move on, you did bring up neon, so I'm gonna you have some really great neon. I'm thinking just offhand the Thunderbird.
Yes.
And let's just get a quick
That's
list.
A great story.
Thunderbird and the cottage. Why don't you just, instead of me poorly remembering these, why don't you quickly give us some really great neon signage that people can come out and see?
Yeah. So there's the one that I know you're interested in is the George's Burger sign, which is on Magnolia, which is a great sign and still at this time in pretty good condition. We also have the Thunderbird sign, which doesn't have its context anymore. If you've seen that sign, it's sort of sadly surrounded by a hotel that's been terribly modified. That was actually kind of the first time that Riverside debated whether neon was important or not. And it happened before I got here. And so they did save the neon sign. And I've since heard that the owner has so many people asking about it and actually coming to the hotel specifically to see that sign that he's now really excited about it and talking about landmarking just the sign. So
let's stop. This is a good point. Okay. Yeah. So every city comes to this crossroads in its preservation policy.
Okay.
And the decision, the crossroads is, do you preserve signage? So this is an important question. So give us a little bit of the narrative of that process under your tutelage.
Yeah, so the best way to preserve signage is like this George's Burgers, or you know, the other one that you mentioned, which is the Farmhouse Inn. So the Farmhouse Inn, which is also on University, just like the Thunderbird. The best way to preserve it is with its context intact, because especially in the case of the Farmhouse Inn, all those great little structures help kind of tell the story of that sign. George's Burgers, same thing. You know, it's a little burger stand with
very good plane. Burger stand. Yeah. Great interior dining area too. Untouched probably since 1965.
It's, yes, but, you know, little tiny columns with a, you know, overhang so that you can stand there outside of the sun, because certainly we don't have rain here in Riverside, and order your burger. So it helps to have that context. So the Thunderbird, without the context, it does put us in a bit of a dilemma. What we would have to do is determine if the sign itself met the criteria that we have for determining whether something's significant. And because the Thunderbird sign is fantastic neon, like really incredible, it looks like a totem pole of a Thunderbird. And so it's really appropriate for that time period too, right? When we were sort of glorifying all that type of decor. It probably could hold it on its own. But in not all cases could neon, like George's, I don't know if that sign would fly without the building, you know, just on its own, because it doesn't have incredible sort of neon art as part of it, but the sign itself has a lot of important detail to the context of the building. So they kind of work well together. So I think we would consider it based on our criteria. You just have to meet one of the criteria for either a landmark or a structure of merit in the city in order to be designated. So it depends. And every city has different sets of criteria as to, you know, whether or not something would qualify. We don't stipulate in Riverside between a building or a site or a sign or an object. Like, as long as it meets the criteria, then it could be designated.
I don't think George's is going anywhere. We were there. We split a vegetable protein burger today at Coop. They had a little really long line. I don't think they're going anywhere.
If you're into vegetable protein burgers, then you absolutely have to go to the Lucky Greek, which is also a vintage era building.
Oh.
It's on Merrill over by the plaza, which used to be a modernism era shopping center that's now been changed, and get theirs.
Okay.
With the zucchini.
Excellent. Yeah. You got it. Let's keep moving down that list.
So I think the other one that you had was
the gas station.
Right. So we have a Walter Dorwin Teague building in Riverside.
This is 1936.
It's currently located at First and Main Street in downtown Riverside. It's looking for use. So if anyone out there is looking for a great gas station to reuse, please give us a call.
Okay. Now you have to describe this gem of streamlined, modern, industrial design.
Yes. So it's also a streamlined, modern style. So it has the speed lines running around it, which, you know, include the canopy. Walter Dorwin Teague designed, this was an example of the first branded architecture. So if a similar contemporary example would be that every time you see a Volkswagen dealership, the building always looks the same. So that's kind of branded architecture. McDonald's did this for a while too. But Texaco was the first, and Walter Dorwin Teague was the first to come up with it. And this one that we have on First and Main is a really good example of the two-bay style. So there was a couple of different versions that had more or less bays. I think there was a one-bay too. So it's in really good condition on the outside. We even recently, the city painted it in the Texaco colors, so it even played up on that more. And it's located in a location really close to some condominiums nearby. But what's really cool about Teague, I think, aside from that he came up with the idea of branded architecture, first one, is that he also was a designer for companies like Kodak and Ford and Boeing. So he really did have an interest in other types of design, and I think that really maybe influenced why he came up with something like branded architecture, because he understood there was product, you know, in architecture. Yep. So
brilliant. I think it's time for you to talk about Clinton Marr and how you and he kind of got on the same path.
Right. So I'm really lucky in that.
Oh, wait. You need to remind everyone, you are the preservation officer for the city of Riverside.
Yeah.
And I'm saying this in a good way. This is not a disclaimer.
So we interviewed Clinton Marr for the Modernism Context Statement because he has done a couple of our pretty significant buildings, like the Standard Insurance Building, or the one that he's most proud of, which is the Provident Bank Building on Central Avenue, which is a really great building.
This is this beautiful glass block on this platform with pilotes, and it's just in back of the Desert Building. You saw it from the Desert Building, but we were late to meet you. We weren't late, but we were like, we can't. It's a really beautiful, like 64, 65, really, really beautiful building.
Yeah, so that's the building he's most proud of. When we asked him, that was the one that he said he was most proud of. It's that classic modern building where it sits on, you know, what appears to be a floating base, you know, that's made of something heavy and sort of tied to the earth, but yet done in a really light way. So it almost appears to float. And then glass above it, absent a cornice line, you know, all those sort of typical features. It has a really nice overhang, too, that I believe the drive-thru used to go through. And it's still a Provident Bank. I believe it was built as a Provident Bank, so it's still owned by Provident. So Clinton designed that building. He's actually designed one of our Modern Justice Center. This is kind of a later example of his from the 80s that has a bit of Michael Graves-ness to it. If you think kind of the Portland building that Graves designed, a little bit like that, where it's a box, you know, like kind of the jewel box concept. But in the day, Clint has actually built two houses for his family. He built one for his young family that is located fairly close to the plaza, and then he decided to build something slightly larger, which he was a veteran, so he built it with some veterans financing. And so it actually had to be a certain square footage. It couldn't be larger than that on a piece of land that at that time was surrounded by orange groves on one side and on the back side completely undeveloped. It's in an area neighborhood now that's known as Horden Hills. He actually owned a couple of plots, including Avocado Grove. It doesn't have that same feel today because he's planted so many trees, and his wife, Jerry Marr, was very integral to the landscaping there. So there's some very large eucalyptus trees also on our property. Single-story property, post and beam, built out of wood. It's built on the 3-foot grid, very Mesian sort of grid. He was absolutely true to it. We asked him during the interview that we had with him what his biggest career regret was, and he actually said, and little did I know at that time I would live in this house someday, that his biggest regret was that he didn't stray from the 3-foot grid in designing the hallway to the laundry room and the kids' rooms, because he said that two people who were of, you know, average size couldn't actually pass in that hallway without stopping, you know, and moving by each other. 3 feet is not a lot of space to, like, pass somebody.
Yeah. But Kim and I have this problem in our modular house.
So that was his biggest career regret. So we came to find out that the house was on the market. I went to look at it just, you know, worried that somebody was going to buy it and mess with its, you know, purity.
Mess with it? You mean buy it and tear it down?
Tear it down or modify it significantly. And so I wanted to see it, you know, when an architect has designed this house and lived in it for 51 years, the period of context for that house, much like I was talking about with the modernism statement, extends for that entire time. And so, and all of the changes that he made, you know, kind of become part of that story. And so I wanted to see it before anyone else came in and did anything with it. I was not on the market for a house. I lived in this really nice Tudor over by Fairmount Park that I loved, and fell in love with the house, came home, told my husband we were going to buy it. He said, "What, are you crazy?" And I said, "We're going to see it tomorrow morning," and he had the same experience. So living in a modernist house changes the way you live. I live in a glass house. There isn't, I think, except for maybe, there isn't a room in that house that I could be in. Oh, our bathroom, the master bathroom, is the only room you can be in and not see outside. So, you know, you do learn to live seeing nature all the time, and it's incredible.
Perfect. I think you did it.
Okay.
I think you did it. Let's just kind of wrap up any loose ends. You have several other responsibilities you juggle your time with, but I want you to look ahead for the next couple years. Yeah. Riverside and modernism. I mean, obviously, preservation is a part of public policy for the city of Riverside. Yay! Good. What's the next big milestone you guys are looking at?
So I think modernism is still going to be a challenge for us. It's been a challenge in Riverside for a while, ever since we started doing this. But the one thing I will say is that it's becoming more commonplace thanks to, I think, Palm Springs. Palm Springs has made modernism kind of a household term. Yeah. People here understand what that is.
And let me interrupt you and really read between the lines. They understand what it is. They see there's money in it.
Well, that's true. That's true. And there's truth in that, in any sort of like preservation argument, sure, especially from a city standpoint. You can always argue that it brings in tourism. That's the easiest thing to say, right? But I'm really concerned, and I think that the community is as well. We found this out even just doing a project with our downtown library, which is a modernist building, that this sort of larger story of what modernism is and that it represents this movement, as well as architectural styles and all kinds of design elements that go with it, is important for kind of telling a significant part of Riverside history. So while it's still controversial, and the reason I would say that it is because we just haven't been, we haven't had enough history pass yet to fully understand where modernism sits in our history. There's a lot of people who are still here who remember modernist buildings being built, and it's hard for them to understand that that might be significant if it was built during their lifetime. And so that, I think, is still a big challenge for us, and it's something we're working on. But what I see in the future is something that continues to focus on architecture, but yet looking for the personal story that goes along with that. So we have a couple of good buildings, the Harada House being one. You can look it up. It's also an incredible story here, tied to a Japanese family. And so tying a sense of place to story, I think, is kind of where we see it going in the future. And one of the things I found really beneficial about talking about these modernist buildings, and you've let me do that here today, is kind of telling the stories about the people that built them and how they lived in them and how it felt to see that design done and what it kind of meant to just experiencing a space. And that is maybe where the future is going to go, a little bit more of a focus on story, but in a way that gives us a better, stronger sense of place. I don't know if we're going to do more surveys on modernism, because we've done two, but what might happen is some of these districts might start to get designated. The Brockton District, the Brockton Arcade area, which I could spend an entire 20 minutes talking about.
We're going to come back, and we actually are. Yeah. Maybe you can meet us at Brockton Arcade, and that's going to be our next interview with you. We're just going to walk through Brockton Arcade.
Two really great restaurants there, the Soup Shop and Little Green Onions. It was just featured in the paper this last week, you know. So there's starting to be some more common attention placed to these, you know, kind of under the guise of, hey, let's, you know, do something with it and not really necessarily change the architecture, but, you know, like, let's identify it as being this really cool place that has a different purpose outside of the plaza, the Riverside Plaza nearby. So you might see some designations of these. We already have a few landmark buildings that are designated, but not as many as, you know, Victorians or craftsman buildings or, you know, some of our more prolific styles, because we have a lot of good examples of those too. So I definitely think you'll see individual designations rise. You may see some districts actually become designated. We don't have any modernist districts designated yet, although we've identified many in our context statement. So that's probably where the future of modernism lies. And the last thing I'm going to add is that I'm really hoping that we can start a local organization. I've been looking at, I've talked to a number of people at doing a Docomomo local chapter, so like a Docomomo IE, Inland Empire, which is what we call this area, chapter, which I think would kind of help bring some focus to modernism in Riverside.
I don't know if everyone listening knows what Docomomo is, so you need to explain that.
Okay. It's an acronym for the Documentation of the Modern Movement. It's an international organization, and it has a national presence in the United States, and just recently Docomomo SoCal was formed, I want to say, a year and a half ago. And there's been a Docomomo NoCal for a while, so the Southern California chapter just recently formed, and that's going to sort of help bringing the attention, I think, to modernism on kind of more of a regional area, maybe better than it's been done previously. So that includes, you know, all the Southern California cities, including Riverside.
Okay, I think Chris Nichols has a new project. Yeah, I think Chris. Charles Phoenix. I'm going to call him. I think Charles Phoenix needs to organize a weekend out here.
He will be here in December at the Mission Inn. He comes and does a show every year. But yes,
the Mission Inn is the Mission Inn. I'm going to call Charles. Okay. Aaron, you did it. This was fantastic.
We'll be back for more. I want to thank you. And again, to wrap it up, just remind everyone your credentials and tell us one funny thing about Clinton Marr you haven't told us.
Okay. So I'm Erin Geddes. I'm with the city. I'm the Historic Preservation Officer, and my background is in architecture. That's my training. The funniest story that I could tell you about Clinton Marr, I think, is when we would call him during the Modernism Context Statement, we'd ask him about various buildings. He had this, we kind of determined this nomenclature of how he'd identify buildings. And so he would use different words to, you know, kind of describe various levels. So we knew, you know, when he called it an excellent building or an excellent example, that, you know, he thought that was kind of one of his better buildings. When it was one of the mediocre buildings, he called it a fine building. It was a fine building. And then when we found some of the buildings that were maybe at the bottom of his, you know, range, he would tell us, well, you know, that building was a good example of how I fulfill the client's need. So we... So we were able to kind of get into, you know, a space where we could tell exactly how he felt about the buildings, which, frankly, if it's one of his better works, that actually does give it a higher qualifier.
Yeah, of course.
You know, if he views it as one of his better works, you know, that's kind of a higher qualifier. And it's not every day that you actually have the architect sitting there you can ask that question of. You know, sometimes what we'll do is we'll look at brochures or ads or articles written about an architect and see the buildings that are referenced and determine what their primary works are based on somebody else's writings. But in this case, we have Clinton, and we can ask him, you know. So, yeah, that's my Clinton Marr story.
Thank you. That was a wonderful story. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Badan Roy. I'm here at Cal State LA, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
And we're done. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of November 24th, 2014. This week, our guests were Steve Leck. He is a docent for the Mission Inn Foundation and Museum. He gives tours of the historic Mission Inn of Riverside. And Erin Geddes. She is principal planner and historic preservation officer for the city of Riverside. I want to thank everyone for listening. We really appreciate it. We really, really do. And I want to have you touch base, Kim, with everyone on feedback. And before you even mention iTunes, I want to say I just got an email from iTunes, and they're going to fix our feed. We're going to reconfigure our new FeedBurner feed so that our FeedBurner page, so our iTunes page, is producing new content again. So just before you even go down that road, let me just say we're going to fix that.
And that happened because you got in touch with someone at iTunes, and as you were telling him about the problem, he was looking at the page and going, oh, this looks like a really cool podcast. And then he started listening to it, and then you started getting emails from him saying, hey, I'm still working on your problem, but I'm digging your podcast. So that was nice, even though we've been a few weeks with a confusing lack of a presence on iTunes. All the more reason, if you're an iTunes user, to go and give us some stars.
Thank you, Kim. And do you want to remind them of our email address if they just want to use 60-year-old technology like email?
Oh, sure, yeah. youcanhitthesunshine@gmail.com is the email address associated with the podcast. You can also go through the contact link at www.esoteric.com. You can join us on an esoteric bus adventure, like Richard's birthday bus, for instance. You can also come to one of the lava events that Richard or I are hosting. And we are always happy to hear from our podcast listeners. Don't be a stranger. Thank you.
All right, Kim, we're in the exit portion of the podcast. That means it's time to talk about upcoming bus tours, my birthday bus being the most important bus tour of the year. And I'm looking forward to being listed in a Thanksgiving weekend listing in an online publication about, you know, the best thing to do with yourself over Thanksgiving weekend. So why don't you bring us on home with upcoming bus tours and start with my birthday bus.
Happy to. Well, once a year, Richard has a birthday. Most people do. They have belly buttons, too. And every year, it's a completely unique adventure into the Southland, usually not in Los Angeles proper. The idea is to go places we wouldn't ordinarily go on the bus, to see sort of beneath the curtain of Southern California lore, to visit some things that are really special and off the beaten path, and to do it in good company on what is essentially a rolling birthday party bus.
With my mother.
With your mother. With your mother sharing embarrassing stories of you as a child and sometimes having the mic taken away from her. And slideshows. And fun. And this time, there's actually an Indian feast. And the tour is hosted by our dear friend, Nathan Marsak, America's wackiest and wittiest cemetery historian, and neon historian, and Bunker Hill historian.
And desperately in need of publishing his next book.
All the more reason to keep him busy giving bus tours of the public mausolea of Orange and Los Angeles counties. We're going to some of the most beautiful architectural spaces in Southern California that just happen to be community burial vaults. So, seldom seen unless you go to a lot of funerals, unless someone you know happens to be buried in one of these. And some of these smaller mausolea that we're going to see on the tour are not even generally open to the public. So,
not at all.
At all. So, this is really special. If you love Southern California architecture, you're going to see not just some very, very cool and interesting spaces and learn their history and their context in the development of cemetery architecture, but also some fantastic decorative art, some really good tile. And an Indian feast. So come out. You don't have to be a close friend of Richard's to join us on his birthday bus. You just have to love to adventure in Southern California and want to be part of it. And we do still have a few seats left, so come out and ride with us. Then we have two more tours before the year is done.
Oh my God.
It's true. And they're crime bus tours, so they're kind of my babies. Pasadena Confidential with Crimebo the Clown on December the 6th. And this is scheduled so that there will be time for you, yes, you, gentle listener, to dress up really cute on the tour and get up close and personal with Crimebo the Clown and take some pictures that you're going to use for your holiday. Probably not your cards. It'll be a little late to get cards made. But, you know, when you put your really cute pictures up on your social media accounts, you and Crimebo in your Christmas sweaters, you know what I'm talking about. Sucking on candy canes. Plus, it's a really cool tour about just the offbeat side of Pasadena. Rocket science, black magic, very eccentric, out of control millionaires, presidential assassins, school shooters, troublemakers near and far, and some beautiful architecture. So that's false imprisonment. That's Pasadena Confidential. But Crimebo the Clown. Oh, yeah. And we've newly added to the tour is a really special late 19th century Victorian structure that somehow survived and has a really cool story, several really cool stories attached to it. Not just in the past, but in the present. So if you haven't been on that tour in a while, there may be some things you haven't seen. And if you read the big Cameron piece, the cover story that Tanya Lawton did in the LA Weekly about the artist Cameron, she features in the tour too because she was married to Jack Parsons, who's one of the most interesting rocket scientists included. And also a black magician. Okay. Eastside Babylon, December 13th, my most unhinged crime bus tour. And it's the tour where we're going to go and stop at Brugier's Dairy in Montebello and have some milk and cookies and eggnog, because you'll have earned it after you hear the really scary stories that I'm going to start that tour with. Commerce, Montebello, Boyle East Heights, East Los Angeles. People did some really bad stuff out there. We'll talk about the Night Stalker. We'll talk about the Radio Shop murders. Oh, we will. And we'll go visit the Carneys in Evergreen Cemetery. Now, between these two events, on Sunday, the 7th of December, is the Raymond Chandler free event with the walking tour that you and I are leading after Barry Day's book signing and talk.
Mark Chevalier
is going to join you and give a little bit of an insights into the Oviatt building, which, of course, features In the Lady in the Lake by Raymond Chandler. Who's this Raymond Chandler guy, you ask? Well, he's the subject of my novel, The Kept Girl. And your bus tour, Richard. Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles, which is coming up on January the 24th. And that's the tour where we have gelato, noir-themed gelato from Scoops, which I'm pretty sure if you held upside down would fall on the ground. But I get ahead of myself.
It would, Kim.
I'm not putting Dairy Queen down. I'm a Dairy Queen fan. I was a Dairy Queen in Las Vegas, Nevada in maybe 1974 when I just, you know, was kind of, well, I knew how to read, but I didn't always read everything. But I was reading. I was like, banana split. What could that possibly be? And then we ordered one, and it was just mind expanding. Like, who came up with that idea? Okay.
Don't forget Teresa Reinhardt.
I'm not going to forget. Okay. It's complicated. Preservation is pain. Tours in 2015, because I skipped ahead to Chandler, but January 24th is not our first tour of the year. Our first tour of the year is always the Real Black Dahlia, and on January 10th, we're almost sold out, so if you want to get on that first tour, it's good, Richard.
I know.
It's around the time of year the Best Short was kidnapped. We follow in her footsteps. We talk about the culture of these sort of footloose women of immediate post-war Los Angeles, of whom she was one, this almost unrecognizable downtown, and the very interesting investigation and media response to this notorious and still unsolved, very brutal murder. So it's an interesting tour, and it's a very moving experience to do that tour at this time of year. The Bukowski Tour, Charles Bukowski's Los Angeles, is January the 17th. Also a tour that begins downtown and moves to other locales. We talk about Bukowski as a postal worker, Bukowski as a poet, Bukowski as a lover of John Fonte and a haunter of Broadway and the downtown neighborhoods and the job boards along the Nickel, Fifth Street. And then we end up in East Hollywood, where he reinvented himself as an internationally known novelist and poet. Chandler, again, January 24th, and 2 days before that, on January 22nd, Richard and I will be giving a presentation on my novel, The Kept Girl, and other aspects of Raymond Chandler and 1920s true crime at the Pasadena Central Library, which is on the National Register, by the way. And also in that noir sort of side of the world, a very occasional tour, and one of my favorites, January 31st, it's your James M. Cain tour, or Jamie Cain, as you like to call him, The Birth of Noir. A tour about...
I call him Jamie Cain because a friend of his got on the bus about 4 years ago, and at the end of the tour said, "I like your tour. Good job." You seem almost exasperated to say James M. Cain every time you talk about him, as you should. His friends called him Jamie. I'm giving you permission just to call him Jamie and relax the cadence of this tour a bit.
Jamie Cain, a tour about how Cain's fiction fed this incredible machine in Hollywood and in the publishing industry that created what became known as film noir and the hard-boiled school of American letters. And it all begins pretty much at the corner of Fifth and Los Angeles. It's a really fun tour, and we get to go all the way to Glendale to Mildred Pierce's house. So that brings us up through January. Of course, in February, we have our California Culture Series and the second edition of the revised Wild Wild West Side. But you can see all of this on our website. But we'd love to see you on the bus. So come out and ride with us.
Kim, good job. Thank you for bringing us home. I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to ask you to continue to listen. And I want to remind you,
you can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Hermina between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine.